You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te waia mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica. I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show, I spoke to Brooke Van Velden about lowering the voting age and National's plan to combat youth crime for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party. I also spoke to Dermot Coffey, a co-convener of the New Zealand Climate and Health Council, who represent health workers and students around the motu, about their decision to join the Free Fares Coalition. And lastly, I also talked to Rachel McIntosh, the Vice President of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, about their calls for the government to follow Australia's lead in committing to eliminating violence and harassment in the workplace. Kia hau whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So tuku pātuhi mai, you can text me on 5395. Why am I running? Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka awa I wariwari, I ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō he pakihiri roki roki mā runga, I te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on our website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
Now, let's get into our chat with one of the most important minor parties about the political hot potatoes of today and tomorrow. This week, I spoke to Brooke about a Supreme Court decision that the voting age of 18 is inconsistent with the right in Section 19 of the Bill of Rights to be free from discrimination on the basis of age. We also discussed National's pledge to send serious youth offenders to boot camps if it wins the next election. I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court's decision that the voting age of 18 is inconsistent with the right in Section 19 of the Bill of Rights to be free from discrimination on the basis of age. What do you make of this ruling?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting ruling from the Supreme Court, and it goes against what the Court of Appeal and the High Court had originally said, which is that as things stand, they're okay. So it's gone to the Supreme Court, and in part, I think they're right in that there is a clause within Section 19 of the Bill of Rights that says everybody is free from discrimination from the age of 16, at which point, legally, people over the age of 16 are deemed adults in a lot of legislation. But I think where the ACT Party disagrees, and where we actually agree with the dissenting view in the Supreme Court, is with Judge Koss, who said that, yes, while you have the ability to be free from discrimination under Section 19, the Bill of Rights separately has its own clause, Section 12, which says everybody over the age of 18 has the protected right of being able to vote within the House of Representatives. And we believe that that clause and that section overrides and prevails over the generalised right to freedom from discrimination. So while, yes, this has been upheld by the Supreme Court as an inconsistency, it's inconsistent with a generalised clause, not with the clause that's specific to rights being able to vote within the House of Representatives. So I think what we've seen on part is a lot of advocacy for people who want to lower the age for being able to vote in Parliament. But what we're also seeing is an explicit right carved out within the Bill of Rights that says that the age is 18. And I don't believe that that has actually truly been acknowledged in the Supreme Court case.
Changing the voting age for general elections would require a supermajority in Parliament, but for local elections that isn't the case, and Labor would be able to pass that on their own. Would the ACT Party support lowering the voting age for local elections?
Well, it's an interesting point again, because you're right, in the Bill of Rights that's specific, that the right to vote in elections in the House of Representatives or Parliament is at 18, whereas it doesn't say what that right should be in a local election. So I think there is a clear ability for there to be a challenge for local elections. And I suspect that's probably the point at which the Make It 16 campaign should try and advocate. The ACT Party has been very specific that we will not support a change to the electoral law for the Parliament. But I think we are open to the idea that it could change for local elections because, you know, what damage could it really do?
Right, so would that kind of be the underlying reason then that you would support local and not general because of potentially the outcome being not in favour of ACT?
Well, I think what it is here is that there's been a reason why it's explicit within the Bill of Rights. You know, most countries around the world do have their law and the ability to vote set at 18. And we don't really see a need to change it because, of course, we've got so many problems in our society at the moment. You know, you think of cost of living, you think of crime, you think of co-government and the change to democracy. And I believe there's too much that this government is trying to rush through when we're changing our democratic institutions and our rights under the law. For this also to happen, I believe, would muddy the waters. But that's not to say that we wouldn't be open to the idea of the local elections being brought to Parliament. I think as a caucus we'd have to have a wider conversation on what we would do at that stage. But certainly my overarching concern is that we're changing what it means to be a democratic nation on so many fronts at the moment with co-government in our local elections, with co-government in our healthcare reforms, and the three water reforms. I think adding a change to who and what rights you have to vote at the same time again is far too much change all at once. And so I wouldn't support the idea that we have this discussion, but I understand from the perspective of advocates and people in the community who are looking for this change that it's probably the area that's the most likely to go down.
Right, and speaking of that, so when you were sort of 16, 17, Brooke, what was your sort of view on these issues? Did you have sort of that desire to vote similarly to some of the advocates that we're seeing?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I was focused on school and I was focused on making sure I turned up on time so I didn't get detentions. I was focused on, you know, music and my extracurriculars. You know, at the time, that wasn't really a huge focus for me of whether I should or should not be allowed to vote. But I don't think this is about me. I think this is about all New Zealanders. And the overwhelming majority of New Zealanders do not want to see this change occur. You know, all of the polls we've seen is overwhelmingly people were in favour of the status quo. So I think if we were to have a real talk about constitutional change of changing the voting age, we would have to see more desire in the community for this change to actually occur. And I don't even think you're seeing that in Parliament.
I want to talk about the National Party's youth offender policies that they've recently released. And this includes a pledge to send serious youth offenders, which they clarified on our breakfast show this morning that it wouldn't be 10 years old, it would be as young as 15, to boot camps if they win that next election. So this is a policy that they've previously introduced. What does ACT think of this as a measure to address youth crime?
Oh, look, we welcome that the National Party is wanting to get tougher on crime. This is an area that ACT has been calling for some time. And I think we need to see real consequences for lawlessness and more consequences for crime. But where we differ is I don't think it is actually our role to be telling the military that they now have to babysit wayward children. You know, I'd like to actually have us in a conversation with the military to see whether they've even got the capacity to do that. So that's where I differ a little bit on sending kids to boot camps. The alternative that I would like to see is a setup again of ACT's charter schools. You know, in the previous election, I went to go and visit the Vanguard Military School. Now, this is a school that's taken kids from very disadvantaged families, kids who have mainly dropped out of school or have been so severely bullied that they'd never bothered to turn up to school. And they gave them a purpose, and they gave them people who looked after them in the community, people who were ex-military as well, who would give them drills to do. They created a culture where kids who had never felt the need to go to school actually really thrived and started passing NCA with really, really good results. I want to see more choice in our school environment where we could see more troubled kids being given that sort of help in an education system that provides for choice with real structure and more community wraparound support rather than going straight to a military boot camp.
Right, and some people would say that maybe instead we should be addressing the root causes of youth crime before it gets to that point where someone would be offending repeatedly. How would the ACT Party address those causes of youth crime?
I think there are many factors to youth crime, but in particular when we're seeing these kids who are going out and creating ongoing stress in communities with ram raids, you know, the police actually know who they are. No, these are repeat offenders who don't turn up to school and they're out causing havoc with their mates. It is quite easy for us to identify them and give them a different amount of support. And I think a policy like the charter schools model, where you'd be able to identify kids, refer them to a charter school who would be able to give them a different type of level of care than just asking them to turn up to school, would work. And I think of the example of one of the Auckland charter schools that actually employed an ex-All Black to be a truancy officer and knock on kids' doors when they didn't turn up to school in the morning and dragged them to school. Now, he created an environment where not only was he enforcement, but he became a male role model for these kids who knew this guy in my life actually cares whether I succeed or not. He knows where I am every day, and he's going to make sure I'm getting to school. And even forming that kind of bond under the charter schools model meant that some of these kids actually started attending school rather than going out and not attending school, and changed their lives around for the better. And they will have a much greater success story than any other kid.
Back in 2017, ACT criticised National for these policies, saying that they don't work. Do you still stand by this, and why do they not work?
Well, I think what we're wanting to see is, yes, we have to be tough on crime. Yes, there has to be consequences for crime. But we also need to acknowledge that these are children, that if they're put in a situation where they're removed from society for a few months or a few years, and then they're put back into society, it's not necessarily the case that all of that good work will continue in a different environment. So I can understand the desire to remove someone and put them in a boot camp, but at the same time, I think a better approach is one where you're allowed to give them structure, give them support, give them consequences for crime, but in the society that they will live in for the rest of their lives. We need to make sure that any change can be an enduring change.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
And we'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Batico Beats with Enrique Morales and guests with support from Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
DJ Zarisha and Bobby Brazuca.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Drunken Piano, in association with 95BFM, presents Automatic, live at Whammy Bar, January 15th. With their new album, Excess, out now on Stone's Throw, the Los Angeles trio are bringing their retro-futurist motoric pop to New Zealand for the very first time. Automatic. One night only at Whammy Bar, January 15th. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar.
Wednesdays, 1-4 Bridge. Tune in for your fair share of great open-minded tracks. A wide range of supportive and encouraging music with Bridge. Kick back and chill with the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Your vibes aren't ever the same.
Treat your feet at the Pat Menzies Shoes Black Friday sale, kicking off this Friday. The home of footwear in Auckland since 1975, this is Pat Menzies' biggest sale of the year. Almost everything in store is 20 to 30% off. That means Doc Martens, Vans, Converse, and more. 20 to 30% off. Don't miss Pat Menzies' Shoes Black Friday sale. 4 days only. This Friday through to Monday. Canterbury Arcade, Queen Street. Excludes Birkenstock and some selected styles.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire, 95BFM's news and current affairs program. Let me know what you think of this next piece coming up, or any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395 to let me know your thoughts. Today we're going to be talking about Ōtautahiao, the New Zealand Climate and Health Council, who have just joined the Free Fares Coalition, the Aotearoa Collective for Public Transport Equity. I spoke to Dermot Coffey, a co-convener of the council who represents health workers and students around the motu, about why they are joining the call to make public transport free and accessible for all. Here is that interview. Can you tell us a bit about why you made this decision?
We've been very happy to lend our voice to the coalition. Our main reason for getting behind it, our main reasons for supporting free fares is that we advocate very strongly for a healthy climate response within the country. So one, not only that reduces our climate emissions, but also optimizes the health outcomes and the well-being outcomes as a result. And I think the Free Fares Coalition and the message that Free Fares Coalition has aligns really, really well with our messaging. So we've been delighted to kind of come on board and support it. It's a really extensive list of members and supporters, you know, so right across the kind of advocacy community, but political bodies and things like that as well are looking to keep the cheap fares and probably extend it in the coming years as well.
For those who might not be aware, you've touched on it a bit, but can you tell us a little bit more about the Free Fares Coalition and your goal?
So the coalition, it's made up of a wide number of members. So people like Generation Zero, Greenpeace, and a number of the community organisations like Presbyterian Support, Sustainability Trust in Wellington, a number of the universities, and some of the local body councils as well. Christchurch City Council, I'm based in Ōtautahi myself, and Christchurch City Council is on it, Dunedin City Council, Wellington and Hutt City, and so on. And interestingly, there's quite a lot of support from some of the youth branches of the political organizations like Young Labour, Young Greens, and the student associations around the country. So that, I suppose, represents maybe the people who stand to get most benefit from this. And the aim of the Free Fares Coalition is to continue the subsidy that allows half fares, which is present at the moment, to continue into 2023, but to extend that so that everybody under the age of 25 and anyone with a community services card would get free fares. And I suppose, look, from our point of view, it would be good to extend that even further, and that free fares would be offered to everybody in the country. That would be the ultimate goal. It sounds like a big step, but it's not. I mean, this is something that's been done in countries like in Luxembourg, in Malta, and in a number of cities around Europe. And Scotland's brought in free fares for under 22s, 22 and under, I think, just recently. So this is something that is happening. Obviously, the push is to facilitate and kind of maintain that mode shift that's going to be critical as part of our climate response. I mean, one of the biggest sources of climate emissions in Aotearoa is from transport, and that essentially means private vehicles and particularly cars. And within an urban environment, really, we need to make a big reduction in the use of private vehicles. I mean, part of that will come from electrification of the fleet, but I think a significant part of the part that has been overlooked by our government to date is that mode shift. So switching to active transport and to public transport, that has to be a major part of it as well. From our point of view, the health gains, you don't get those health gains from switching from an internal combustion engine car to an electric car. You do get them from switching to public transport. You do get them from switching to active transport. So we need to see that mode shift, and this is something that will facilitate it.
Right, and as you mentioned, that half price fares scheme is due to end at the end of January next year. So do you have any concerns about how this might affect people's mode of transport, and do you think this may deter people from potentially taking public transport?
Yeah, I think it is a barrier. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And the work that's been done in Wellington shows that there's very good awareness of the fact that public transport fares are lower at the moment than they have been. There are difficulties with public transport around the country at the moment, and part of what we have to do is to remove as many barriers as we can. One of those is the cost, and reducing or preferably removing the cost would be one of the barriers that we have under our immediate control. The question that comes up as well is around the overall cost to the country of this, but when we put it in kind of dollar figures, if public transport was free across the country for everybody, that still would only be about a quarter of the cost of the subsidy that's been put on for petrol around the country, which is happening at the same time. So in dollar terms, it's not a massive figure. And I think the benefits that can be accrued from it make it well worth doing. There are other things that need to happen with public transport. Obviously, it needs to be expanded. There needs to be frequency. There needs to be accessibility, particularly for people with disabilities. There needs to be an expansion of public transport into the outer suburbs around the country. And it needs to be reliable. It's one of the biggest issues at the moment in our cities, is that reliability isn't there. But these are other things that can be done. None of these things mean that we should not have free fares. They should be done as well as having free fares. I think that's the important message that comes across. The one other point I'd make is that in countries where, like in Luxembourg, where free fares have been in for a while now, it makes the sort of scheduling and the logistics of public transport far easier. There's no tickets you have to buy. You don't have to top up your card. You don't have to stop and start, tag on, tag off when you get on the bus. You just walk on, get the bus, it stops, you get off. You get the train, you jump on, you get off. It makes it much more simple. And that is a big impact as well on the sort of work conditions for people who are actually driving or working within the public transport infrastructure. It makes a big reduction in the hostility that they can often face, which is often tied in with paying and with fees. And it just makes it simpler. You get on a bus, you're just driving it. You're not having to take change out and all these kind of things. So it just makes it more streamlined and more smooth.
Opposers of free fares have made the claim that there isn't enough demand for public transport, that people aren't using it, so there's no point investing in it. What do you make of these claims?
We hear that a lot, and we hear that a lot for active transport as well. I would completely disagree. That statement can't be made because we don't know if, you know, the demand, when the public transport, when good public transport is put in place, the demand is there. So people say that people choose not to take public transport, but I think with the public transport infrastructure at the moment, people don't have the opportunity in many places to make that choice. Free fares reduces one of the barriers. It's really important, and it's particularly important for people who may not be able to afford a car, may not have the resources to afford it. People who can't drive, there's a lot of people for medical reasons, and we see it a lot, who can't drive. And elderly people who maybe don't feel as safe on the road driving a car as well. But it's one tool among many, and all the other things have to happen that I mentioned, that expansion of public transport at the same time. You know, there's that statement that Kiwis love their cars. You hear this all the time. And I would say, look, people in New Zealand don't have a choice, a proper choice, compared with countries overseas. And we have to give people that choice before we can make statements about Kiwis loving their cars and things like that. And I think we'd find that once public transport, as we see with active transport and public transport all around the world, once safe, predictable, reliable and cheap, or preferably free public transport is provided, people use it. The demand is always there, and it's that old build it and they will come, or induce demand, that applies equally for public transport and active transport as it does for private transport and for cars. If you build a motorway, people will use it. If you build a light rail route, people will use it. You just have to put it there, and it just has to be, as I say, reliable, predictable, safe and cheap.
That was Dermot Coffey, a co-convener of Ora Te Ao, the Climate and Health Council, about why we should make public transport free for all. We'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Making her triumphant return to the stage, Phase Days is coming to the Hollywood Avondale, one night only, November 26.
Her first time performing in New Zealand since 2020, Phase Days is celebrating her new EP, Break, with new music, new merch, cool zines, and support from Car Wash and Handy.
Phase Days, Saturday, November 26 at the Hollywood Avondale. Final tickets on sale now from Under the Radar.
95BFM presents Viu Whakature, February 21st at the Hollywood Avondale. All the way from Mali, the legendary Desert Blues ambassador and his band will perform cuts from his extraordinary catalogue, including one of the albums of the year, Le Racine, and Ali, his five-star collaboration with psychedelic Texas trio Crunbin. Viu Whakature, Tuesday, February 21st at the Hollywood Avondale. Pre-sales are open now at banishmusic.com/subscribe.
Sharon Van Etten and her full band are returning to New Zealand, performing live at the Magnificent Civic Theatre. It's a must-see show, so you must see. And you can. If you'd like to win tickets, get your B-card ready all this week on 95BFM Drive. 95BFM presents Sharon Van Etten with support from Nadia Reid, December 12th at the Civic Theatre. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Chiba Chiba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
And you are listening, as David Seymour just said, to The Wire. This week, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced his plan to ratify International Labour Convention 190. The convention is the first international treaty to recognise the right to a workplace free from violence and harassment, including gender-based violence and harassment. I spoke to the Vice President of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, Rachel McIntosh, who is calling on the New Zealand government to follow Australia's commitment. The New Zealand Council of Trade Unions is calling on our government to follow Australia's lead in their commitment to eliminating workplace violence and harassment. Can you tell us about what commitments Australia has made?
Sure. Australia committed to ratifying an international convention that came out of the International Labour Organization that provides a framework for both responding to but also eliminating violence and harassment in the whole world of work. So it's not just at workplaces, but it covers interns, it covers applicants, it covers informal workers, it covers the commute, it covers basically it recognises that work spills out into the rest of people's lives.
Why is this convention in particular so significant in protecting people against violence and harassment?
It creates a right for the first time, like an internationally recognised human right to be free from violence and harassment in the world of work. And it also it takes a new approach, so not just a health and safety approach, which is about risk, not just a rights approach, which can be by individual, but also recognises that there's power relations that lead to these things, particularly for gender-based violence, particularly for queer workers, particularly for migrant workers, young workers and older workers. It recognises all those things and it calls on governments and employers and workers to kind of work together to sort that out and to prevent, to educate and to respond appropriately as well.
How does this convention sort of differentiate from our existing labour laws against harassment in the workplace?
It will. Our laws go a reasonable way to addressing the problem, but this convention actually has higher standards, so it would require some change. One of the things it calls for is gender responsive systems. So that's like judicial systems that take into account power, that are not just the old adversarial, from the old British justice system kind of way, which is our current thing. So it requires some rethinking, some redesign, and really encourages the voices of victims to be heard, and also the perpetrators to be dealt with. At the moment, it's quite common for a so-called solution to violence and harassment is just you sack the perpetrator. They're still in society. They go on to work somewhere else. This is about addressing underlying cultural causes as well.
Can you tell us about some of these underlying cultural causes and what this can look like?
Sure. So, sometimes it's a manager who abuses their power over the people who report to them because they have greater power. Sometimes it's gender-based. So, generally, men or cis people in a workplace harassing, belittling, diminishing the contributions of women, gender minorities, those kind of things. If you go to a gathering and you ask people who have some experience of violence and harassment in the world of work, pretty much everybody puts their hands up. Like, we all know what it feels like, and that currently something needs to change in order to address it, and that's not just responding when it happens, but it's also preventing it. Increasing the kind of respect that, respectful relationships in the workplace as well.
Do you have any insight you could share on the current situation in Aotearoa and sort of how widespread people are affected by issues like these? Obviously, it's an ongoing issue, but do you have any insights to share on particular industries and sort of the widespread scale of this issue?
It's definitely widespread. The Human Rights Commission has actually just done a survey on it, and it shows what you might expect when you think about the power differentials at work, that Māori workers, Pacific workers, women workers, queer workers are disproportionately affected by violence and harassment. And some people who, if you ask them if they've been bullied, they say no, and then you describe bullying behaviour and they say, oh yeah, I've experienced that. So, it's a really interesting study, and it is across all industries, but in some places it's more likely to happen because of the setup at work. Like, for instance, nurses get harassed or attacked walking from hospitals to their cars because car parking's not provided close enough. There are things like that which are you know, you can see the obvious practical solution to that is that there's better protection around the commute. But yeah, it's pretty widespread.
What would your call be for our government to do to ensure that people are properly protected from workplace harassment and violence?
Well, first of all, start the process for the ratification of this convention, and then start working with unions who represent workers and employer groups to bring about the kind of change, education, better responses, better resourced inspectorate and so forth for improving things.
And I just wanted to add, if anyone listening has concerns that they want to address about whether they may be experiencing violence or bullying in the workplace, who can they reach out to? Where can they go?
They can contact their union. If they don't have a union, they can contact the Council of Trade Unions, who can provide advice or referrals. And there are a number of organisations that that deal with this. There's Refuge, there's an organisation called Shine, there are quite a few. But yeah, start by talking to your union, and if you don't have one, contact the Council of Trade Unions.
That was Vice President of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, Rachel McIntosh, on their calls for New Zealand to do more to combat violence and harassment in the workplace.
That was The Wire.
Ko Irati Hōtaka, katoa, mō tēne wiki, ni te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēne rā. That is a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ni rā hoki, te mihi, ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. See you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.